on time for once. And so let me start by discussing the where we were yesterday. So now that we understand quite well the action of conformal transformation in spacetime, we're proceeding to understand better how that symmetry acts on a quantum field theory, more precisely on a conformal field theory, which are the theories that have that symmetry. And step one that we have to understand in that framework is to understand how the symmetries are realized on the operators of the conformal field theory. Another way of saying it is how the operators transform under conformal transformations. So we're discussing, and the subject of this is the conformal fields, which are the fields that transform nicely under conformal transformations. But first we recalled, in a language that's very useful to generalize to conformal transformations, how fields transform under Poincaré transformations. And the reason I went through that is that, well, first of all, the conformal group, as we know, the conformal transformations contain as a subset of transformations of Poincaré transformations, so it's a prerequisite to discuss the action of conformal transformations to know Poincaré transformations. But also because we will see that once we understand this structure in the right language, the generalization to conformal is very straightforward. So here, just to recapitulate, what we did is remind you that if I make a Poincaré transformation, where this is the translation and this is the Lorentz rotation, then what we found, what is if I give you a space-time field, phi A of X, under such a transformation, you get a new field that can be written as follows. So there is a piece of the transformation that acts on the indices of the field and characterize which representation of the Lorentz group the field transforms under. And then there was a part of the transformation that acts on the space-time coordinates, like that. Where G, by GX here, just I'm using this shorthand notation by saying that this is the same as G dot X, G acting on X. Okay? And then we saw that under infinitesimal transformations, essentially, because if I make an infinitesimal transformation, I can do a Taylor series on the small parameter that parameterizes the transformation. So in this case, I just think now of A mu as being small, and I replace this by a small. Sorry. So here, the way to think about it is you go back to the original point plus some small shift. Okay, and what we notice is that the transformation of the field under such a Lorentz transformation, well, remember these guys, by definition, oh, sorry, yeah, so sometimes I forget to put this, sometimes it has no meaning, this, so I'll try to be consistent, but so the variation of phi is the difference between the transformed phi minus the original phi. And this had a form where, let me get the signs straight. There was a piece which was just coming from the space-time part of the action. So it just essentially, so remember that this, we like to think of it, and it will be useful when we do conformal, to think of it as a small coordinate transformation parameterized by a vector field V mu. So that this G inverse here, so that in this approximation, G inverse of X mu is just X mu minus V mu. So this first term is just the derivative B mu times the derivative of the field. And this just comes from expanding this, right? You just do a Taylor series. And then, and this is the part of the transformation that we call the orbital transformation. Because it doesn't act on this index, it only acts on the position of the field. And then there was a spin part, which can be written as this. So we have to supply the information about the field is encoded in how it transforms, which representation of the Lorentz group it transforms. So this R is a label for the representation of Lorentz group. And this X on the indices of the field. And this was what we call the spin transformation, the spin part of the transformation. Okay? So this is how the most general vector would field would transform under Lorentz transformation. Okay? So all I have to tell you, there is one part which is just geometric, and any field transforms exactly the same way, where this V is this vector field. And then there is a part which is field dependent, which is in a way characterizes the representation. Okay? So once you tell me the representation of under the Lorentz group that your field transforms under, I can write this down by just constructing these. These are just finite dimensional matrices. There as, so this A and B go over from 1 to the dimension of the representation, which is essentially the number of values that this big index A and B take. And I wrote down a few examples for the scalar, vector, and spinor. And you can, as an exercise, you could try to construct what these matrices are for an object that's not a vector, but it's, for example, a symmetric tensor. So an object here that would have two space-time indices, like mu nu. Look, let's call it rho sigma, not to confuse. So an object that has two indices here, rho sigma, you should be able to compute what this matrix is. Okay. And the reason that this is nice is that, as I said, in quantum mechanics, if you have two transformations, I can make another transformation. I can put them together and get another transformation. And in this language, what this means is that if I compute the commutator of two variations parameterized by two different Poincaré transformations acting on the field phi A of X, what you get is just another variation under another Poincaré transformation, B3, acting on phi A of X. So that the transformations are realized nicely on my fields. Okay. And B3 is a new Lorentz transformation, which is a function of the parameters of the original two Lorentz transformations. So can someone tell me how this vector field is related to this origin? How would you guess? I mean, you have to do a computation, but given what we've discussed in class, how is B3 related to B1 and B2?
Commutator.
The commutator of vector fields. So remember that we had these vector fields Bi, where I say goes from 1 to 2. And these guys, indeed, the commutator of two vector fields gives you a new vector field, and this gives you V3. And we wrote down the expression of V3 in terms of V1 and V2. It's just essentially V1 times the derivative of V2 minus V2 minus the derivative of V1. And now if you, as an exercise, you can show that given this explicit transformation, that if you compute this, you'll indeed recover this fact and a match with the formula for V3 that you obtain just by using the vector fields, the commutator of two vector fields. So any questions about this? Because I'm going to move now to conformal fields, per se. So everything is clear? Okay, so in the conformal field theory, there is a set of fundamental operators. So this is a subset of all operators in the theory. In some theories, the set of such operators is finite dimensional. Most generically, it's infinite dimensional. And the ones that are finite dimensional will play an important role when we study two-dimensional conformal field theories, because when it's finite dimensional, these are theories that will be able to compute everything about them. But for this discussion, we don't have to specify whether the number of fundamental operators is finite or small. And they're fundamental in the sense that all other operators in the conformal field theory are derived from this, okay? So just to give you what the jargon for these things are, so the fundamental operators are called primary. They come first. And the other ones that you get from this, which actually the way you obtain them, as we will see later, is actually by taking derivatives. So we call this guy O, a set of operators OA, where A goes from 1 to the dimension of this space of fundamental operators. The derived ones, essentially, you can obtain just by taking derivatives, as many derivatives as you want. Okay? And these operators of this type, by this I mean L derivatives. I don't put all the symbols. These are called descendants. Because you get just by acting on the primaries. And the point of this, the reason that these operators are very important is that if you know how to compute the correlation functions of the primary operators, the correlation functions of the descendant is uniquely determined by symmetry. Okay? So essentially, you've solved the problem of CFT if you've computed the correlation functions of primaries, of the primary operators. Just to connect with things that we're familiar when we study quantum field theory in the Lagrangian framework, these primary operators are the analog of the fields that appear in the Lagrangian. So when you study quantum field theory that has a Lagrangian, you have a set of fields. And essentially, any operator in that theory can be obtained by multiplying the fields together and taking derivatives. So the primaries kind of play the analog role. Okay. But now we're studying not Poincaré invariant theories, but conformal field theories. So now we have to understand how to generalize this kind of transformations. But we already know that we'll have to supply more data because the conformal algebra has other generators other than the Poincaré generators. In particular, there was this nice object d hat, which was the dilatation operator. And I already explained that one of the key quantities you want to know about the CFT is the spectrum of the dilatation operator. We will have a set of eigenvalues. So when we, so judging intuitively, since we're making a space-time transformation, it will be, it should be clear that a space-time transformation acting on an operator has two pieces, one which is purely geometrical, which is the orbital part. This will still be true for a conformal transformation. This is just a statement that you shifted the position of your coordinate from x to x minus b, so that you always get this term by just doing the Taylor expansion. And then there is the spin part, which knows about the intrinsic properties of the labels of the field, which for the case of Poincaré transformations, I only have to tell you the representation of the Lorentz group. But in a CFT, which has conformal symmetry, I have to tell you two labels. One is R, which is a representation of the Lorentz group. And a number delta, which is the eigenvalue of the operator O, let's call it O, under d hat, which is the dilatation operator. So the d hat, so you can diagonalize this operator, and then you have some eigen operators. Okay? And these guys, delta, the eigenvalues, are the conformal dimensions. Of the operators. And these are the things that are directly related to the critical exponents in critical phenomena, to the behavior. For example, another application of these conformal dimensions of operators is when you study QCD at very large energies, the theory is almost conformal. And the behavior of some scattering experiments at very high energies, the behavior of those experiments are controlled by a particular class of dimensions of some operators in Yang-Mills theory. So these are kind of the, it's a big deal to know what's going on with these guys. And essentially what we want to do is compute the set of all dimensions for the primary operators. Oops. Because, as we will see in more detail later, but it's intuitive from this description of taking derivatives, the dimensions of the descendants of a given primary are completely determined in terms of the ones you know the dimension of the primary, because a derivative just raises the dimension by one. So it's like you have these infinite towers of operators, and if you know the dimension of the guy at the bottom of the tower, you know the dimension of everyone in that tower because this just increases by one. Just like the harmonic oscillator. And this is a consequence of the fact, indeed, that the commutation relations of the conformal algebra has a piece that looks like the commutation relations of the creation and annihilation operators acting on a Hamiltonian, okay? So just to set it more in formulas, so if I give you, so this is the dimension, so if I give you a primary O, this has dimension delta that we don't know, we have to compute that, and in two dimensions, we'll also even higher dimensions, we will tell you ways of computing this. So, and this is the primary. And the descendant would be, the first one would be this. But this guy we already have the intuition that a derivative has mass dimension 1. So this will have just delta plus 1 and so on. So if I act here with L derivatives, this has dimension plus L. And this goes all the, continues all the way down like that. So what we'll have is for each such primary operator, we'll have one tower of operators like that that you go down just by acting with derivatives. And one way, just to connect with maybe some tutorial that you had earlier in the week, these dimensions, you might wonder, where do these dimensions appear in a conformal field theory correlator? And as we will study in much more detail, but in a way you already know from your knowledge of at least free field theory, is that the spectrum of these delta A's, the dimensions of the primaries, is contained in the two-point functions of primaries, primary operators. And by that I mean that if you compute the two-point function of a primary operator located at the point X and another primary operator, OV, located at a different point Y, as we will derive in using conformal word identities, but you already have an intuition from massless fields in free field theory, conformal symmetry fixes the behavior of this two-point function to be of this type. And in fact, you can orthogonalize the operators like that, and this is delta A. So if you compute the two-point functions of your primaries in the CFT, you can extract the dimension just by looking at the power law behavior of your two-point function. Any question about this? Okay. So I already said that in order to specify the transformation of a conformal field, I have to give you this extra data. I have to give you the data of the representation and of the scale dimension. So the question is, how do we have to modify this kind of transformation? How do we have to enrich this transformation so that it applies to conformal fields, not just Poincaré invariant fields, or fields in Poincaré invariant theories? So, let's see. Maybe I'll try to fit it here. No, it won't fit here. So I'll move here. So let's make a conformal transformation from X to X mu. Remember that these transformations we obtained as solution of this equation. I'm just writing it again so that we have all the formulas in front of us. This was the statement that the metric just rescales under this transformation. And omega was the conformal factor. So given this data, the generalization of this is actually very, very simple. Under a conformal transformation of this type, a primary field transforms as follows. So, and then we'll compare with the formula we have written there. So I have that. It will have a piece, will look very similar. So it has a piece that acts on the internal indices of the operator. But this is a matrix which depends on some on some series of on It's a okay, so the way to say it more precisely is that this is a particular representation of a particular Lorentz transformation, which I'll tell you now what it is. I have to tell you what this matrix R is. This is a particular Lorentz transformation times phi b of G inverse. So far, this is identical to this, except that here, what we will see is that that R, so here, this G was a Lorentz transformation. The Lorentz transformations are parameterized by a constant parameter, right, lambda. What we'll see is that in a conformal transformation, you can define, you can construct a Lorentz transformation where the parameter of the transformation is actually x-dependent, okay? And the new thing that happens is that we have to specify what is the information in the transformation of the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator. And that's actually as simple as it could be. It's essentially just a Jacobian factor of the transformation. Where you take this transformation, this is the determinant of, well, this is the Jacobian of the transformation. If I make a transformation, I can construct the matrix of derivatives, and this is the determinant of that matrix. Delta is the dimension of the operator. That if you want, I could draw a label here to tell you that that's a quantum number that that operator carries. And D is the number of space-time dimensions. Okay? So in a way, a primary field of dimension delta transforms what is called like a density. Because when you make a coordinate transformation, you have there are objects out there that, apart from transforming in the usual way with the partial derivatives, pick up this Jacobian factor. So just to make this, what I'm saying, a bit more concrete. So you know that if you make a coordinate transformation and you map, so let's look at for a vector. You know from your GR course that the way you compute this transformation is notice that this guy, another way to connect what we were saying yesterday with this language is that this matrix here, for example, for a vector, I wrote some explicit formula of what this matrix looks like for a vector, is the matrix that you would have obtained just by computing this matrix of derivatives. Actually, you can construct the representations of tensor representations of the Lorentz group just by writing down the formula that you know for how tensors transform, and you can extract the spin part of the transformation by essentially computing the matrix that multiplies the field. Okay? Is that clear? Okay, so this is how tensors transform, but there are objects that you can define, so you can have, in general, tensors that have a certain number of upper and lower indices that will have as many such matrix factors as number of indices that you need, where x tilde will be upstairs for upper indices and downstairs for lower indices. But in general, if something transforms as a density, it can have something like that. To some weight omega times all these matrix. So if I have here P of these guys, I'll have P such partial derivatives. And if I have Q of these guys, I'll have, I'm not writing all the indices. I think by now you know what I mean. Okay, let me maybe write. So I have P such transformations associated to the P upper indices, and I have Q transformations. Notice that they work in the opposite way by general covariance. And here I have the same guy, or whatever. And this is the density. Omega is the weight of the density. So it's a number that depends on the field that I transform. Yes? Yes?
Phi or O?
Yes, sorry. I'm writing O for conformal transformations because using Lorentz transformations, phis are fields that appear in the Lagrangian. And in conformal field theory, O's are operators that may have nothing to do with fields in the Lagrangian. So if I make a mistake again like that, please let me know because it can happen. And this W is the density weight. Oh, sorry, yes. Yes, it should be good. Thank you. Yes?
What about the Dirac field? It's not really
intense. Yeah, so that's much more subtle. Well, it's not much more subtle, it's more subtle. And for that, I think it would be taking me a little bit away because I have to talk about, I don't know if you've seen this in the GR code, I have to talk about Bilbind and spin connection, which would take me too far away. But there is definitely, you can definitely transform spinners. I mean, yeah.
Space time at some point, so we'll have to see them.
Okay.
After Christmas.
So, as for that, I would have to develop some formalism where you need to introduce what's called the Bilbein, which is a local field that has a Lorentz symmetry, actually. And since spinners are defined to transform under Lorentz transformation, you need to define it with respect to these local frames. But that would be a little bit too heavy for me to do here, but you can definitely do that, yes?
Okay. Why do the primary operators have to transform like that? Is it just like a definition or is it something else?
Well, so there are several levels of answers you can give. One of them is that they have to represent the transformation. So you have to construct objects that have these properties. That if I make two consecutive transformations, it will give you back another conformal transformation. And actually, we will see. We will see that. I made a little detour here. I still haven't told you what R is and so on. So, it shouldn't be completely obvious, but it should be almost obvious. That's why I'm going through this. If you remember how tensors transform under coordinate transformations in GR. And just remembering that there are some guides that pick up this extra factor. Okay? Taki, can someone tell me what object you know that when you make a transformation like this would pick up such a non-trivial Jacobian?
The terminal of the metric.
The terminal of the metric, yeah. Or another way of the epsilon tensor.
The epsilon
tensor density,
not the epsilon
tensor. Well, but I mean more concretely. Sure. So people know what this, and I don't have to go through this, right? Okay. So the thing that you know, like the determinant of the metric that has this property, that pick up this extra factor, or the epsilon tensor also pick up this factor.
So, yeah. So the point is, you think the determinant of the metric should be a scalar because it's got no indices?
Yes.
No free indices. But actually, it does change somehow under.
Yes.
It picks up the scale factor.
Yeah, so that's why I wanted to do. Let's see. So if I take. Okay, I'm going to see if I can cook this up without making a mess. Let's see. So let me. And now let's think of M, of this guy. as a dividing, as a, okay, in this case a 2x2 matrix. Okay, imagine this is just a two-dimensional space. So actually, if you compute this, this guy actually is the determinant of this matrix. Is this a formula that you've seen before? This is one way of computing the determinant of a 2x2 matrix. And notice that in this language, this guy has a non-trivial weight factor. This guy is exactly precisely that, in fact. Okay? So the last thing is, so this is not something very exotic. This is something you've seen before. So a conformal field is, in that way, just not very far from things you've seen before, where now you have this non-trivial Jacobian. Yes?
In the density way,
yeah.
The transformation of V, why is the x tilde below the line?
Well, it is a matter of definition. I could just, if you want, put it the other way around, and then the weight will be negative. But the way it's nice to think in conformal field theory, actually, but let me say it in this language, is that conformal fields are nice to be nicely thought to be objects with lower indices with respect to conformal transformations. So if this has a lower index, so you here you have tilde x's, so you have tilde x's downstairs, and this guy has x indices downstairs, so you have to have the x upstairs. But I mean, I could just change this and put a minus sign here if you wanted. More questions? Okay. So I told you how this thing transforms, but I have to tell, I didn't tell you what this R matrix is. So let me tell you what it is. Have one? Okay. Sorry?
What's
happening? The one behind it, yeah.
Oh, the one behind it. Okay. So should continue here. Okay.
Yeah, I'm here to please.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so now we meet this funny conformal transformation, and then I have to tell you what this R is. So this is a matrix. It's actually very similar to this, to the matrix that you get when you make a coordinate transformation. But it's enriched by this. Okay, so let me write it and then explain. So it's essentially the naive matrix that you would get when you make a coordinate transformation, the Jacobian of the transformation. But it is enriched by the conformal factor, by one power of the conformal factor. Okay? And the reason I do this is that it's a straightforward exercise to show, and this is very related to something that you did yesterday, to show that actually this matrix, thought of as a D by D matrix, has the property that's orthogonal. So let's be now in Euclidean space. It has the property that if I multiply this R times R transpose times R, I just get the identity, just one. So this implies that this is an orthogonal transformation. So that means that R is an element of O, if I'm in D space dimension, the space time dimension is an element of OD. It's an orthogonal transformation. Just like here, this guy was an orthogonal transformation, okay? But now one fundamental difference is that this transformation is not a constant anymore. It's a function of x, but it's still orthogonal. And that has to do with the fact that the vector fields, well, that when you make a conformal transformation, you have non-trivial X dependence in the transformation. Okay? Another way we can write that top equation is by taking the determinant. So let's take the determinant of this equation. From this, we extract. I want to write this Jacobian factor in terms of the conformal weight, the scale factor. So if you take the determinant of this matrix, what you find is that the determinant of this times the determinant of this times the determinant of that, so equals the determinant of this. So this is dx tilde square, because I have two such matrices, right? Equals, and this is a d by d identity matrix. So the determinant of this matrix is essentially omega to the 2d, right? So that means that I can write equivalently the transformation of a conformal field, conformal primary field. As O tilde AX equals, notice that the power of D will cancel, so I'll just get omega X to the D, to the delta, sorry. That's the scaling weight. OB, this Lorentz transformation with X dependent parameter, times OB G inverse X. So this is the transformation property of a conformal field. So now let's play around a little bit so that you feel happier with it, maybe. So first notice that, let me do it here. Now let's look at the subset of the transformations, which are Poincaré transformations. So under a Poincaré transformation, the conformal field will transform exactly as what's up there. In this blackboard, precisely like that, because in this case the omega factor is one, right? Because a Poincaré transformation is isometry, so this omega, capital omega, which is the conformal factor, is just equals one, and therefore I just get one here, and this R just reduces to the usual Lorentz transformation. So for Poincaré transformations, we get recover the usual transformation properties of fields. Now let's make then the other simplest transformation we can make. Let's make a scale transformation. Let's see how a field transforms. And this will give us back the intuition that delta has to do with the dimension of the operator. So and let's make this transformation to be like that. Let me say it inverse for no good reason. Otherwise, I'll have the inverse in some other place. This minimizes the number of inverses I have to write. So now let's just compute this. So in this case, actually, maybe it doesn't. So omega. Okay, no, it does, yeah. Because in this case, omega. So I have to compute for you now omega, right? Because this guy is that appears everywhere. But we already know that in this case, under this transformation, omega is just lambda, right? Because this guy is just Well, okay, let me be very pedantic. So. So the determinant and from here we read that, okay? So that means that under a scale transformation, the operator O, oh, I made a mess here. This is omega is lambda inverse. So let me see. I mean, the simplest way to see it is just, let's go back to here. X is so is it clear that if I make that transformation, I get a I get a lambda square. Okay, so I was right. Okay, I don't know what I'm doing, sorry. So let's look at for a scalar. Not kind of to decouple what's happening with these indices to what's happening with the scaling weight. So what we find in this way is that O tilde of X is lambda to the dimension of the operator times O lambda X. So under a scale transformation, a primary field transforms very nicely, transforms homogeneously. You rescale the coordinate, and you pick up some overall scale factor. So it's a homogeneous, in a way, it's kind of the closest to a homogeneous function under scale transformation. Just, you have to rescale just that operator by some factor. And as we will see in more detail next time, but just to anticipate, the fact that scalar operators transform like that under scale transformation has the nice, we can use it to essentially determine how the two-point function, and recover this formula that I just erased, in fact, how the two-point function of two operators with dimensions delta 1 and delta 2 transform, because the way you determine the position dependence, as we will see more carefully in the next lecture, is that equating the two-point function of the original fields has to be the same as the two-point function of the transformed fields. Now we use the fact that we know how O tilde transforms. So what I get is that I get lambda to the delta 1 plus delta 2 times O1 of lambda x, O2, lambda x, okay? And now we're just using the fact that in a theory that has Lorentz, has a translational symmetry and rotational symmetry, O1 of x, O2 of y, has to be a function of what? Just based on, okay, so if you have translational symmetry, let's do it in more steps. And I give you that I want to compute a correlator between an object here and here. What does the correlator depend on? The difference. So it will be a function of x mu minus y mu. And rotational invariance says what?
Take the square root of the
length. The distance, yeah. So with just this knowledge of translational and rotational invariance, and I'm going to this to see how powerful conformal symmetric constraints is. What you know is that this is going to be an arbitrary function in general of the distance between the two points. And the thing that's very remarkable about CFT is that the extra symmetries of a scale invariant and a spectral conformal symmetry give you a completely unique form of f of x minus y. And now we'll determine it, because all I have to do is equate f of x minus y. This guy has to equal this guy. So this is lambda to the delta 1 plus delta 2 times f of lambda x1 minus x2, sorry, x minus y. So which function has this property? So of course, I mean, the function that has this property So we have fixed the possible functional form of the two-point function just using a scale invariant, and it can only be of this form. Yes?
In O2, no, it should be a Y there, shouldn't it?
Oh, sorry. Thank you. And actually, in the next lecture, we'll see that actually conformal symmetry makes yet even a further restriction. It will. Remember that the conformal transformations have this funny special conformal transformation. And what that will tell us is that the correlation function actually vanishes if delta 1 is different from delta 2, what we will have is that this two-point function vanishes, which is very powerful constraint. Okay. So the reason I'm going through this is to see that this kind of transformation properties under scale transformations give us back things that you've seen in free field theory, like the fact that free field theory has these properties. Yes. These are for primary operators.
Okay.
Notice that a non-primary operator, a descending operator, is never a scalar, because you have to add the derivatives. So certainly, here you have an object with indices, and you compute. What I'm saying is that you have an object like, well, these are Lorentz indices. You need, just by Lorentz invariant, something upstairs here that has Lorentz indices, right? And here's some power. And in fact, in this lecture, we will show that conformal invariant also uniquely fixes these tensors. So these are tensors that you have to cook up. These are tensors that have nice properties under conformal transformations. And in fact, we will determine that. Yeah. But again, these constraints only apply to the primaries. You can have primaries that are not scalars, but vectors. But then the point is that the descendants are trivial. If I give you the two-point function of the primaries, that of the descendants is trivially related just by taking derivatives. Because a primary here would have a derivative here. Well, just take the derivative here. That's all. Any more questions? Okay, so now we've understood the finite transformation under arbitrary conformal transformation. Now let's look at the infinitesimal form and compare it with that for the Lorentz, infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Okay, so let's just now look at the infinitesimal transformation. And BMU, we've already seen it many times, so let me write it again. So this is the vector field that generates infinitesimal conformal transformation. So just the addition with respect to that one of the scale and a special conformal transformation. And then just working it out, and I will not do all the details here. It's really exactly identical to the calculation for the Lorentz transformation. All we have to do is expand things infinitesimally to leading order in those parameters, okay? A, B, lambda, and B, and omega. And what you get is this. So you get a piece that you should have guessed already, which is the orbital part of the transformation. Notice that it looks identical to the one for the Lorentz transformation. The only difference is that now the vector field is more general than the one for Lorentz transformation. So here, this V corresponds to this. Then we have a piece that looks like a Lorentz transformation. But now, instead of being parameterized by this constant omega factor, is parameterized by a non-trivial, well, slightly non-trivial, a parameter, which is a function of x, and I'll tell you what it is, times the finite dimensional matrix that tells you the representation of the operator under the Lorentz group. And finally, there is the piece that depends on the scaling weight. So that and these guys, okay, in the language we were using before, this will be the spin part of the transformation, because this is the part that knows about the intrinsic quantum numbers of your operator, which, as I said many times before, is R, which is a representation of Lorentz, and delta, which is a dimension of the operator. Notice that this structurally is identical to this, orbital plus spin. The thing that changes, and I've written it in this way. Probably, if you look at Di Francesco in the book, he writes this in a way which I find maximally non-intuitive, in the way that he writes this as some function of coordinates. But the point is that you can organize the transformation in a way that you can associate part of the transformation directly to Lorentz and part of it directly to a scale transformation. So you can just by staring at it say, okay, so this transforms like in some representation of the Lorentz group with some x-dependent Lorentz parameter, and this transforms with some scaling weight with some conformal factor omega x. Okay. So something that you can try to do is, if you look at Di Francesco, try to write whatever he writes in the textbook in this form, and you'll see that it's exactly the same. But this one is more appealing to the eye because you can just see what's happening. You can see that you just made a shift of coordinates and a Lorentz transformation and a scale transformation. Okay. And now all I have to tell you is what these things are. So omega mu nu of x, of course, will be omega mu nu. Because imagine I had just done a Lorentz transformation. I would have to recover this, right? But now the point is that, actually, that if you make a special conformal transformation, it's kind of a strange thing. You make a special conformal transformation, and that induces a Lorentz transformation. In formulas, what this means is that omega mu nu has a piece that depends on B. B, remember, is the parameter that controls the infinitesimal special conformal transformation. And what this formula is telling you is that if you make an infinitesimal special conformal transformation, it induces a rotation on your field. This is quite nice. Yes.
In the spin, the scale part in the spin.
Right.
I include the scaling part, infinitesimal transformation, into the spin also. How do you?
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question.
No, I ask just, is it obvious that the last part is a kind of spin also? Can you introduce?
Well, no, the scalar is no spin, right? Because the index A is not touched at all.
Yeah.
The scalar. Just the scaled operator by something. Doesn't mix up with the Lorentz indices.
But you're saying that's the spin part of this whole expression. You've got the orbital and the spin part.
Yes.
You're including that in the spin bit, though.
Oh, I mean that because this, from the point of view of representation theory, this is the, one way you could say this is delta is the determines the representation under the dilatation operator. The point I want to make is that this transformation does not act on the space-time coordinates. Whenever you act on the space-time coordinates, you shift fields. And this does, right? So all there is no derivative here. That's why I call this zero on top. It's like, yeah. It's really with analogy with this, that here you're messing up with some internal indices of the operator, but not with the space-time dependence of the field. So here we have this x-dependent Lorentz transformation, which includes the usual Lorentz transformation, plus an induced one by a special conformal transformation with parameter b. And this omega x, remember that if I make an infinitesimal transformation, we define omega x, if I make an infinitesimal conformal transformation, this is 1 minus omega x. Okay? So an omega x is just 1 over d, which is the space-time dimension, times the derivative, the gradient of the vector field. And this has two pieces, one which is the obvious one, which is the part that you would get just from a constant scale transformation, so that's parameterized by the parameter lambda, which is just the scale transformation. But something interesting happens again, is that if you make a special conformal transformation just by itself, this again induces a scale transformation, because you have an extra piece here that depends on B. Yes, that's one way of doing it.
How could we do that?
Sorry?
How could we do that?
So for that, I would have to talk about, maybe I can discuss it later.
Okay.
In order to explain that in that language, I would have to explain it in that language for the Poincaré group. That will take me a little bit. But here I'm doing something which I hope looks totally trivial, which is just take this object, and expand to the leading order in the small parameters, A, omega, lambda, and B, and just reshuffle all the terms that you're going to get to put them in this form, so that we have an intuitive understanding of what's going on. Okay. So you see that in this language, a conformal transformation is exactly like a x-dependent Lorentz transformation plus a dilatation. That's it. And now the thing that you can show, note that this is, to see that this is making sense, just like you can do for for Poincaré transformations. So we're claiming that this is how conformal transformation acts on the primaries. Now what we have to show is that this is indeed a consistent transformation. And the way you show that is that if you make two consecutive conformal transformations acting on the field, you get exactly another conformal transformation, I think, on that field, where again B3 is obtained from the commutator of the two initial vector fields. That's something that you can check. It's a bit, I mean, it's a straightforward algebra, but it's some algebra to show that. Okay, so now let's look at a kind of break down a little bit this theory to see some bits and pieces for the simplest operator. So let's look at the scalar operator under a pure dilatation, so that only lambda is non-zero. So I just make a scale transformation and nothing else. Then this just gives us that the variation of the field x is minus x mu d mu plus delta acting on over x. So the variation of the field is proportional to a piece which just rescales the field, because x dx is like a rescaling, plus the eigenvalue of that field, of that operator with respect to the dilatation operator. Something I should say is that it's very important to stress that this transformation or that transformation is the one valid for primaries, okay? This is very important. And the point is that descendant operators do not transform this way. But anyway, we can explicitly compute how they transform. And in particular, what this means is that, just to give you a simple example, I will not go through it now, but imagine now you compute a descendant. I said that it's the derivative. Yes? Yes. If I make the variation of a descendant, well, let me just say this schematically, and if people are interested, I can explain it after class. It will have a piece which is very similar to this, but it will have a piece which is not homogeneous. In delta mu O. Okay? And maybe I'll leave it as an exercise to show that if you take O to be a scalar operator. So just take this formula for a scalar to show that the derivative of the mu O has all the pieces that you would expect from it. And one that you don't like, but it's life. It's expected that it's there. But it's not a surprise at all. But. So if you make a conformal transformation of d mu phi, you get this guy that you expect. This is just the orbital part. What you do is you take you have to shift the derivative of the field, so you get field times derivative again. You get this. The reason I'm going through this is also interesting. It tells us something nice. It tells us that if O had a scaling dimension delta, the derivative of O has a scaling dimension delta plus 1, which is our intuition. A derivative increases the dimension by 1. Now O was a scalar, but now d mu is not a scalar anymore. It's obviously a vector. It has a vector index. So this guy now has a Lorentz transformation. And then there is this part, what I was saying here, is this is the inhomogeneous part of the field. And this kind of term is definitely not here, okay? So I'm just saying that descendant fields are not primaries, which is something that you know, but this is how you see it in formulas. You see it that it doesn't transform in the way that primaries do. But in any case, we don't care, because if we know how to calculate things for primaries, we know how to calculate things for descendants just using the conformal symmetry. Okay. Should I say this? I'll say a few final remarks about this, and then next time we'll be prepared to study correlation functions of primary operators. But let me say, no, this blackboard is important. You shouldn't mess with that. Shouldn't mess. Everything is important. Okay, this. If people want next class, so tell me if you want. I can do what Callum was suggesting, which is you can derive this using some other method, which is called the method of induced representation. But that is a bit more heavy, a little more heavy knowledge of perhaps representation theory. Well, the way I chose to present it is just something that you're very familiar with, which is how tensors transform. But if people are interested, I'm happy to discuss it in that language, though. Okay. So what's special about primary operators? Something that you can show is that primary operators. So, okay, the first thing I want to say is that remember that in the case of the conformal algebra contain these generators like B, P, and K. And we made an analogy that this was like the Hamiltonian of a quantum mechanical system. This was like the creation operator that increases the energy of the system by one. And this was the annihilation operator, which decreases the energy of the system by one. And so here we have a little bit of a puzzle, because if I give you an operator, I can decrease its dimension as much as I want by acting as many times as I want with A, which is K. So that means that if I'm allowed to act as many times as I want with K, I will get a spectrum of operators which is unbounded from below. This is not very physical. Just like in quantum mechanics, the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is bounded from below. In that language, what it means is that there is a state that has the property that it's annihilated by the lowering operator, okay? And this gives you the lowest energy state. So you have the spectrum which is bounded from below. In the representation of the conformal algebra, you can think it also in this way. The primary operators are below, are the lowest, I'm using this loose language, energy state, even though I already mentioned yesterday that the spectrum of the dilatation operator is indeed the spectrum of some Hamiltonian. So that means that the operator K mu actually annihilates the primary, because it tells you that if you act on that state, you get zero. Doesn't let you go below that. So in that sense, it's the lowest energy state. Okay? So it's the operator that's annihilated. Primary operators are operators that are annihilated by the special conformal generator. Yes. A closer analogy to this would be that when you study angular momentum in quantum mechanics, so you have SU2, you have spin, and you have J, which is the spin. I'm saying the language that tries to not get too much into representation theory, but I'll make a direct analogy with something that perhaps is more familiar. So you have spin. And then you have M. Okay? So in quantum mechanics, for SU2, you have three generators, right? You have J1, J2, J3. They satisfy the. Okay, this I has nothing to do. Let me call it AV. just to avoid any possible confusion. So this is an SU2 representation, SU2 algebra. And now you can construct representations by specifying the spin of the representation. And you know that if you have a spin J, all states in that representation are labeled by two numbers, J and M, where M goes between J and minus J. This is something hopefully totally familiar, right? Okay. So the analog, the closer analog to primaries is the statement that in any given representation labeled by J, there exists a state J where M equals minus J with lowest amount of M, which is the azimuthal quantum number, which in this language means that this state is the one that's annihilated. Okay, so just to remind you a little bit of this, so there is a nicer way of rewriting this algebra where you define J plus, J minus. Don't trust any factor of two, but I mean, roughly speaking like that. Something that you know from your quantum mechanics is that J plus, acting on a state J mu, well, it gives you some factor you have to compute. This lambda has nothing, okay, some alpha. Okay, let me say it like that. So J plus, acting on a particular state with fixed spin and azimuthal quantum number, increases the azimuthal quantum number by one or decreases it by one. And this guy is exactly the state that plays the role of a primary, because this state is the lowest state in the representation. Yes?
So you're, in this example, you're talking about actual operators acting on states. But in our primary example, we're really talking about commutators and operators. And can you just explain a little more how the commutator being zero is analogous to a state being annihilated? Because I just see two operators there. I don't really see a state.
Okay, so for that, I will have to explain the what's called the operator state correspondence, which I will certainly do. And this is the statement that in conformal field theory, for every operator O, I can construct a state in the Hilbert space, bra O. And in that language, K mu acting in the Hilbert space of that state equals zero is equivalent to this language. But there's something I will explain. This is called the operator state correspondence. And so you can very nicely go from the Hilbert space picture to the operator picture without any problem. So just to finish here, what I want to say is that in any given representation of a spin J, there is a state which is annihilated by J minus, and which has the lowest amount of azimuthal quantum number that it can have. And the primaries are exactly the analog of this. Yes? Yes?
Right?
Has an inverse.
Can K, like, if you act on that, what you wrote there, like K hat x and O equals 0?
Yes. I don't know how you invert this operator. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure it's invertible, no? No, in fact, there are as many solutions of this as the number of primaries. So in some CFTs, it's a finite number, like the minimal models. And for some other ones, it's an infinite number of them. No, K lives in, like in this language, K lives in the algebra. Yes?
Does it hold for any arbitrary CFT? Or?
Yes. Okay. That's one of the basic properties of CFT. So maybe at some point you should, well, I certainly have to explain the operator state correspondence, but maybe to explain to you more directly what the relation is between, so the point in this business, there are all kinds of operators. There are operators that are acting on the field, and then you have a Hilbert space. In quantum mechanics, at the end of the day, you have a Hilbert space where all the states live. And all these generators, all these symmetries act on the Hilbert space. Okay? And in quantum mechanics, any symmetry is realized on the Hilbert space by a unitary operator. So that means that for every element, every generator in conformal algebra, these guys, there's a corresponding unitary operator that acts on the Hilbert space. And, well, this is not something that I have emphasized, but if people are interested, I can try to explain that. But would people like to see that or not? Okay, write it in Wiki or whatever you do, and if people are interested, I can do that. Even though it's not really central to the way I want to do things, but is that something that, I mean, this is something that presumably you have seen in your quantum field theory course, because there you have to realize the Poincaré group on the space of states, which are the multiparticle Fock space, and there you have to understand how the Poincaré group acts on the multiparticle Fock space, and this is, for the conformal algebra, just a generalization of that, where you have more generators, that's all. So next time, unless people want me to take this detour, I will start discussing the correlation functions and how to compute these deltas. Okay.